The world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II...
A state of war.
...to the present day.
Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
Welcome to this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles. My guest is Marine Corps Sergeant Jeremiah Workman, a recipient of the Navy Cross for his valorous actions during the Second Battle of Fallujah in Iraq. He enlisted in the Marine Corps in 2000, and 4 years later, as a weapons company squad leader in the 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, found himself in the bloody battle known as Operation Phantom Fury, half a world away from his small-town roots.
I was born in Marion, Ohio. It was a town of about 30,000 people. Moved to a small town out in the country, Richwood, Ohio, in 7th grade. Two stoplights. I had 83 people in my graduating class. But played sports, played 3 to 4 sports a year. It's a real small community. Everybody knew each other. That was part of the reason for me wanting to join the military so I could get out of there.
Right. Yeah. Well, I have sort of the opposite experience. I moved to a place like you're talking about, down in the mountains where my nearest neighbor is 3/4 of a mile away. So there's something to be said for both. What about, aside from living in a community of that size where everybody knew each other, what were some of the early influences on your life that made you want to go into the Marine Corps?
I'll be honest with you. I'd say my sophomore, junior year, sitting in the cafeteria at school, and I saw the Marine recruiters come in for the first time. And I just remember looking up, and you can tell when these guys come in, everybody kind of stop what they're doing, and everybody's heads start following them. I was just mesmerized at the time. At the time, it was probably just the uniforms. And then each time they came back, I would pay attention. It was the way they walked, the way they carried themselves, the way they talked. And it just was impressive to me. My father was in the Army. My grandfather was in the Army. So I didn't have really, you know, they weren't pushing me either way, but, you know, I guess it was expected that I would probably go that way. But from that day, that's probably what got me going on the Marine Corps, nothing else really.
When did you go in?
I joined August 28th of 2000, and I left August 19th of 2001.
And after Parris Island, did you still feel the same way?
Parris Island was really weird. I got down there in August. September 11th happened after I was there for a couple weeks. So it was just a really weird time when I was down there. When I graduated and I came back home, it was like September 11th didn't even happen. Because I didn't see it. No newspapers, nothing. And it was still fresh. The wounds were obviously still fresh with everybody. So that was really weird. And, you know, the talk of everybody's going to war and everybody's going to war. But never, you know, I never once thought, oops, I made a bad decision or anything like that. It solidified that I was even more proud to have gone through Parris Island.
I guess what I really meant was the experience of going through Parris Island itself.
Oh, okay.
Changes a lot of people, began a lot of people don't make it.
I think the first 3 weeks for me were tough. I was 17. I was young. It was different. I think for me it was more mental than it was physical. I think a lot of people will say that physically it's not that hard, but mentally it's just from the time you wake up to the time you go to bed, your life is dictated every single thing. After about 3 weeks of that, I remember I was on fire watch one night, and you know, Parris Island, they take you on at night, And they had us, you know, put our heads down so we couldn't see out the bus windows. So I really thought I was on an island, like out, surrounded by water, like an ocean. And me and this other guy were looking out the windows, and I just remember I was trying to look for the water. I was trying to listen for the waves crashing the beach, because it was very like spooky and mysterious down there. You have no clue where you're at. And it wasn't until the day I left when my parents drove me off Paris Island and I realized how small that place was and that the gate was just right there and I didn't even know it the whole time. It's pretty amazing. I also remember we'd go to, they call it the Recruit PX, you know, a couple times you're there to get stuff. They have postcards that you can send, and some of the postcards are overview photos of the island. We would buy those so that we could try to figure out where things were, and we could figure out where the gate was. Mm. Just
what about the process itself? I mean, it's really remaking one. I've read a number of accounts of what goes on, and sort of, in effect, breaking you down to build you up again into something else. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. I went back as a drone instructor, so I got to see it from the recruit's point of view and the drone instructor's point of view. So that's exactly what it is. You get somebody from New York City, you get somebody from the middle of Kentucky, and you got to, obviously they're going to be different, and you got to bring them into the same room and make them work together as a team. I say it's, you got to drag the individual out of everybody. That's what it is. It's 80 to 90 individuals that show up there. And you do have to break them down. The first 10 days is... Now I'm speaking as a DI.
Right.
The first 10 days is when you have to really put the law down. Because if you don't get that discipline in the first 10 days, you kind of lost it for the whole cycle. But it is. It's as a recruit, I was just going along with what was going on, but I did notice that they broke us down, and the first time later on in training that our senior drill instructor talked to us, you know, sat us down and, you know, talked to us about, he was an infantryman, what he did in Camp Pendleton and blowing things up at training ranges. You could see everybody's heads were just getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and, you know, my heart felt like it was beating, like, really hard, because here's this man that, you know, you get dogged and beat down the whole time, and now he's kind of opening up to you. So that's all part of the, I say about midway through boot camp, they try to pick you back up, dust you off, and start pumping you up and making you feel like a Marine and teaching you what being a Marine's about. That's exactly how that cycle works down there.
Tell me about getting to be a drill instructor. And is this something you request or volunteer for, you're selected for, and then do you have to go through special training yourself before you take on the actual role?
It is, there's different, we call them B billets in the Marine Corps, recruiting, embassy duty, and drill instructor. Drill instructor is the only one that they don't come looking for people. Recruiters get, they call it being flagged. Oh, we need 100 recruiters. They just randomly select 100 people and you're going. Drill instructor, they don't do that. You have to apply to be a drill instructor. I came back from Fallujah and I just remember I re-enlisted over there and I was going back and forth what I wanted to do. And I said, you know what, I was thoroughly impressed with my drill instructors. And I knew that, why not? So I put the package in, got accepted, left Camp Pendleton, went to Paris Island, and I checked in for DI school. And DI school is quite, it's just like boot camp, it's 3 months long. But I think DI school is harder, is a lot harder than recruit training. Because now you got sergeants, staff sergeants, and gunnery sergeants. But you're being treated like a recruit again. So here are all these guys from all over the fleet that have had Marines under their charge. Now you're back to square one where it's like being a private again. So that, you know.
Even though you've had all this combat experience and exposure and all the rest, you're Right back at the zero level,
they,
right?
They tell you on day one, we don't care where you've been or who you are. You're here now. And at the time, it really ticks you off. I mean, every day was a struggle for me. But with anything in the Marine Corps, once you get to the end, you see the method behind the madness. But it was physically tough. It was a bear. Mentally, a lot of guys get dropped from DI school for the academics portion. They don't. You got to memorize drill movements verbatim out of the drill manual. Some of these, I mean, for me to sit here and explain one drill movement verbatim could take 20 minutes. So guys, I mean, you racking your brain up till 2 in the morning, all the weekend studying these, because you got to recite these things verbatim, and a lot of people don't make it.
So is the attrition rate, about on a par with recruits?
I think we lose more DI students than we do recruits.
We could do a whole program on this subject, but let's move on. After you finished boot camp, where did you go up next?
Went to a security forces training company in Chesapeake, Virginia. I completed that, and they sent me to Kings Bay, Georgia, to the submarine base to guard the nukes.
When did you go to Iraq the first time?
September of 2004. I did my 2 years at Kings Bay. And then PCS got orders of 3-5 out of Camp Pendleton. Kings Bay was really weird for us, too, because the war started when we were down there.
We're talking this week with Marine Sergeant Jeremiah Workman, recipient of the Navy Cross for his role in Iraq during the Second Battle of Fallujah. We'll continue our conversation after these messages.
Thank you, veterans, for your service to our country.
The great sea and air battle has been raging in the Solomon area since last Sunday.
From the Radio America Network, Veterans Chronicles is now available wherever you are.
Through your MP3 player.
Log on to www.radioamerica.org
and click on the podcasting icon.
Look for Veterans Chronicles. Then follow the information on your screen to subscribe to our podcast.
You can also find the Veterans Chronicles podcast on Apple iTunes.
The Veterans Chronicles podcast.
Now online
at radioamerica.org.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell. My guest this week is Marine Corps Sergeant Jeremiah Workman, a recipient of the Navy Cross for leading the rescue of fellow Marines trapped by enemy fire in Fallujah, Iraq. Before finally being deployed, Workman worried sometimes that his unit would miss the war.
The Marines joined the Marine Corps to fight, and here we all thought we were stuck down there in a non-deploying unit, but it lifted. And I can say one of the best things that happened to me in my 6 years so far was I got to serve with Jason Dunham down there, the Medal of Honor recipient. So that was one of the good things that came out of Kings Bay. But PCS to Camp Pendleton, checked in April. In September, we were on the bird. It was pretty, I checked in and training was already, I'd already missed one training evolution. So it was just bam, 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 one right after the other.
So at that point, you had a pretty good idea of where you were headed.
Yeah, we all... It's the same now. You know where you're going, you just don't know if it's going to be Fallujah, Ramadi. And to be honest with you, that was even the day that we landed in Iraq, it was still a big secret to us. Nobody could tell us where we're going. I remember sitting on my couch in Oceanside, California, watching the first battle of Fallujah on TV, thinking, my God, I'd love to be there right now.
Well, you got there for the second one, which was even bigger.
Yeah.
What were your first impressions on arriving in country?
I think I was kind of, when I got there, I always, for me, growing up as a kid, I always played Vietnam. I wanted, you know, I wore the green boots and the green camis and everything. So that's what my idea of war was, Vietnam, I guess. So when I got to Iraq, I didn't think there was going to be much fighting going on. I didn't think it was going to be, you know, platoons ambushing us, and it's just a different type of war. But I thought I would go there, I would do 7 months and come home, and didn't really believe. You heard about the IEDs, but you never think it's gonna, you're gonna see one. But the very first day, I had a four hour 7-ton ride from the air base to Camp Fallujah. As we were sitting at the gate of Camp Fallujah, a rocket come flying through the air into the camp, and that's the one that it went inside the regimental CP. It killed one of the majors, and it wounded the regimental CO. His first day as the CO there. And that was my first day in Iraq. So, and that's a pretty famous, not famous, infamous day in the Marine Corps. If you say, remember when the rocket came into Fallujah and wounded? Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, that's the day I got to Iraq. So, in my mind, this four-hour ride, I was like, this ain't going to be bad. There's no bad guys. It's just open desert. And then I was sitting there, and I saw that rocket flying. It really opened my eyes really quick. Hmm. That was my first, the heat. The heat was a butt kicker. I remember getting off the plane and just thinking, I don't know if I'm going to make 7 months in this heat. That was pretty bad.
Heat, sand, flies?
Yep. The mosquitoes were bad. I wore this bug spray. It's 100% DEET. I mean, it was so bad. You know, you would soak yourself in the stuff at night just to go to sleep because all you would hear is the mosquitoes buzzing around your ear and biting you and everything. But this stuff was so powerful, it ate through my ballistic goggles. And I just remember, I was like, we're smothering ourselves in this at night just to go to sleep. And look what it just did to those goggles. But at the time, I'd rather soak myself in that than have the mosquitoes eating me.
Well, at the time, Fallujah was an absolute hotbed of insurgent activity. Here you've got a city of about 300,000 people, which has been totally taken over. Yeah. And finally, the decision is made that this is untenable, and it's got to be cleared. Yeah. And you were very much involved in that process. Tell us a little bit about your first exposure to, it may not have been your first exposure to combat, but to combat in that context and moving into an urban environment such as this, and how different was that from what you had expected?
Fallujah was just really, was really weird anyways. I mean, it was like no man's land for us. You would drive down the highways, and the city would be off on the right side of the highway. And it was creepy. You could see it. Fallujah was like a perfect square. And it was just a lot. You could tell it was just a lot of stuff packed in there, a lot of houses. And we didn't know. It wasn't if we were going in there, it was when. So it was kind of creepy for us. You would drive by there, and all you heard was horror stories about Fallujah. What happened the first time, and how they've had all this time to prepare. So I just remember, it was like, no, I mean, it's hard to describe it, but it was very creepy to think about going into that city.
We'll continue our conversation with Marine Sergeant Jeremiah Workman after these messages.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles on the Radio America Network. Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center.
an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out. Get out.
Gentlemen, this is the real thing.
The brutal death march of batons.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the Fuhrer's face.
Feature for Harlem Operate.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Once again, Gene Pell.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell. My guest this week is Marine Corps Sergeant Jeremiah Workman, who received the Navy Cross for heroism in Iraq during the Second Battle of Fallujah.
So let's go to the heart of the matter of the action for which you got the Navy Cross.
Okay. I guess the battle itself was considered to be over. All we were assigned to do was start the north side of the city. And like a squeegee, just every house, anything big enough for a person to fit into, go through it, get all the weapons and ammo that we weren't able to get during the battle, because we were letting the civilians come back into the city. What's the sense in doing this battle if you're going to leave all the weapons and ammo around and they come back in and pick it up again? And we had a Fallujah 3. We did it for about 2 weeks, starting in December. I mean, little things here, little things there, lots of weapons and ammo. I mean, 7 tons full every day. And then December 23rd, there was about 20 of us. We parked the Humvees, we got out. It was section leader, 2 squad leaders. And we always would go over the map, like, hey, you guys are going to do these 5 blocks. We're going to do this side of the street. We got the game plan together. I got 2 houses in on my side, on the right side of the street. And I just heard this, the 249 SAW open up. And at first I didn't think nothing about it because Marines at that point it was nothing to go into a house and unload 2 mags into the mattress and into the closets just because you wanted to make sure. I mean, we were finding people hiding under couches and everything. But as soon as, that happened, then I heard an AK and you could going back and forth. And we were carrying AKs, so it was, once I heard that AK and then the SAW again, I could tell it wasn't our guys. So I grabbed my guys, ran across the street, got inside the houses over there have walls. Every house has like a big concrete cinder block wall around it. They were shooting at us from inside the house. Ran into the house. My buddy Sergeant Kraft, who received the Navy Cross, he was standing on the staircase with Sergeant Guardiola, and they were just screaming up the staircase. And I just remember looking in the wall behind them, like the wall on the staircase was just falling apart from all the bullets. They were shooting all around their head and everything. And they came out, and I said, what's going on in there? They're like, it's just communication really breaks down. Radios. But he said, yeah, they're up there. I didn't know how many. I didn't know who. So I grabbed Marines that were standing around, not standing around, but that were just providing security and things. I said, we got to go in and get these guys. I could hear them up there fighting still. I mean, so I knew that at least some of them were still alive because I could hear the M16s. So we got into like a stack, 8-man, single ranger file column to go up into this house. We went in, we cleared the bottom floor of the house. There was no insurgents on the bottom. Got to the base of the stairs, and the guy behind me hit me in the leg. So I started to go up the stairs. It was like a cartoon. You know, it looked like I was dancing the bulge. And I got halfway up, and then it turned and went up to the second story. And when I got up there, I looked back. They were not able to come, so I was up there by myself because there was too much firepower. I mean, hell, they would all have been killed. But I looked, and I had eyes on the Marines, and they were still alive at the time. They were trapped. One was under a desk, but there was two bedrooms up there, and they were in, like, a foyer room. I had to come back down. They wanted me to come back down and try this again. I didn't want to come back down. I said, you get up here. So I dove back down because I knew if I ran, they were going to get me. Same thing, except this time somebody threw a grenade up the staircase before we went, which is not smart to throw a grenade up the stairs. What it did, it rolled back down the stairs, and we all had to scatter. The only place I had to go was behind the staircase, which it's not like a staircase here. It's a slab of concrete, and it's open. So I saw the grenade, and I thought the shrapnel was going to blow through the stairs. It didn't hit anybody, so we got back in. We went up the stairs. We got to the top. We fought back and forth. There was a lot of firepower coming out of the bedrooms. We were throwing a lot of grenades, shooting our rifles. A yellow grenade bounced out of this bedroom, and I had time. I was the first man up there. I had time to look back and yell grenade, and I kind of brought my leg up like this to shield myself. It went off. I just remember there was a lot of flame. It, like, lit the room on fire because they're homemade grenades. They got a lot of gas in them, whatever they're using. And it felt like somebody hit me in the leg with a ball bat. And I heard guys yell, like, you know, they'd been hit. I looked back. Everybody was still good. I mean, they wanted to continue fighting. But we were starting to run low on ammo. So we had to all come back out of this house. Coming up and down the stairs was like, the way they had this ambush set up was perfect. It was like, almost like they had a bunch of weapons on tripods. And from in their bedroom that they were at, it was like they could see right down onto the staircase. And they were just spraying it. So it was hell getting up and down. But we got out. Marines were running back to get ammo. I saw one of the Marines staggering out of the neighboring yard. And I was like, where did he come from? And he looked like a zombie, covered in blood, and literally was about to just fall face first. And he did. He fell to his knees and just fell over. And I grabbed him, and I was dragging him. He was one of the guys that was in there. At the time, I didn't know what was going on. But I found out later that he had jumped off the roof out of his house. Just jumped because the insurgents were chasing him. I drug him. It was probably about 75 yards, but it felt like 2 miles. I was already dehydrated. I was just hurting. Got him down. The docs were taking care of him. We got the ammo. Pretty much the same group of guys. We went back, went up the stairs. Same thing. We're firing. And now I don't see any Marines up there. So I didn't know if the insurgents had grabbed them and drugged them in there to the bedroom or what. Second grenade comes out. This time it knocks us down, like kind of knocks us down, the pressure and the force of it. I didn't really feel anything from that one. I don't know if I was numb, because I was really getting sluggish, and I felt like I was looking through a straw. It was just getting smaller and smaller. And then my buddy, the guy, the 34-year-old guy from Bronx, I just hear this god-awful scream, and I look back, and he had been shot right through the arm right here by an armored piercing AK round. And I heard him say, I'm hit. I look back, and it was nasty. It was getting really smoky, really dark in there. So it was getting really eerie. The insurgents were starting to come out of the room a little bit. You could see them, like, moving through the smoke. But I had to get Phil Levine out of the house. So we left again for the second time. Got him to the vehicles. The docs were working on him. He was leaned up against the wall, smoking a cigarette. Well, let me rewind a little bit. Before we left the house, he was back there trying to raise his rifle up with one arm to continue firing. And I tell people all the time, that's one of the things that really motivated me, and really, as a Marine, it just, to see that one 30 seconds where I look back and saw a man that's arm is dangling off his shoulder and he's still trying to fire his rifle, that was pretty, I get goosebumps talking about it. But I got him out and he was wrapped up, smoking a cigarette. He was trying to take people's pistols so that he could go back in the house and continue fighting with his pistol, because he couldn't raise the rifle up, but he could still fire the pistol. And I was like, God, Levine, like, some people talk and they don't come through. This guy had talked the entire time. I want to be a blah, 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 blah. And it's like, you kind of chalk it up as, oh, yeah, okay, we'll see when it happens. But this guy was, he's a hero. In my eyes, I always talk about him because he's part of the reason I'm still a Marine. I was getting ready to run back to the vehicle, or to the house, and I looked in the back of the casualty vehicle, and there was two Marines laying in the back. I didn't see any blood, I didn't see anything. One was laying with his hand on his head, it's like noon now, and the sun's right over top, so I thought he was keeping the sun out of his eyes. So I jumped in the back of the vehicle, and I was like, Raleigh, wake up. Nothing. I was like, Doc, I was like, what's wrong? Is he dehydrated or what? He's like, no, he's fine. I'm like, what the heck? I didn't see no blood or anything. So I kept shaking him. I'm like, Raleigh, wake up. I'm like, just trying to slap him a little bit. I'm like, Doc, get the hell over here. He was working. He's fine, man. He's fine. And I'd like tried to put my ear down to see if I could hear him breathing. And I was shaking too bad. I said, Doc, get the F over here. He's like, Workman, he's dead, man, he's dead. It was like somebody flipped a switch on me. It pissed me off. I went into a rage. I just grabbed whoever was standing around, and we ran back into the house for a third time. I just wanted to kill every insurgent in that house. We went back in, exchanged a lot of rounds. They were dropping, the insurgents were falling. But a third grenade came out, and I guess after that one went off, I thought my days were done. I thought I was dying. The straw was getting a little tighter, and it just got black, and I thought that was death. I thought I was dead. And then my battalion XO, like, shook me and woke me up. I just, like, kind of, I don't know if I went unconscious or what, but he grabbed me by my Kevlar, because I couldn't really move. I was puking all over. I was dehydrated, blood. And he grabbed me by my helmet and drug me out of his house. He got a Silver Star. And he was in there quite a bit, throughout the trips, firing. And for a battalion XO to be in there, that's not his place to be, but he's not going to stand back and watch his boys get shot up. So we got everybody out. Got accountability of everybody. And then they needed a Navy SEAL. We were taking sniper fire, so they brought a Navy SEAL sniper in to try to get up on an elevated position to see if he could find the sniper. They need a couple Marines to escort the sniper, so I was like, I'll do it. So me and my buddy Kraft and a couple other Marines, we were escorting a sniper. The tank was sitting in the road. The streets are kind of small, so it was sitting in the middle of the street. The turret was turned. As we were ducking out of the turret, it fired its main gun, knocked us on our butts. Took him up, brought him down, and we got in the vehicles and went to Bravo Surgical, and that was it.
Thanks to Marine Corps Sergeant Jeremiah Workman for sharing his experience during the Second Battle of Fallujah in Iraq and for his service. On the next Veterans Chronicles, Walter Ehlers, a veteran of World War II who participated in the invasion of North Africa, the landings at Sicily, and was on Omaha Beach on D-Day.
The invasion of Sicily, it wasn't too complicated because we landed, and actually it wasn't much of a beach. It was mostly rocks. You climb out of these. Now, the Higgins boats in those days, the one that we had, was a rounded one. It was just called an assault boat, and you had to jump over the sides. If you land in the water, we got in close to the rocks, and we got on the rocks and got up into the town. The Germans weren't shooting at us. After we got into town, we found lots of mines. They mined doors. They mined dead people. And then they had these Bouncing Betty mines. They planted along the roads and the trails. They have three prongs on them, and they put them down in the ground, and they throw some leaves over it. That's all that covers them. And you don't see them unless you spot the wire sticking out or something like that. And we've done that. We've seen them. But a lot of guys got wounded from mines.
A remarkable story from a remarkable hero. Medal of Honor recipient Walter Ehlers. That's coming up on the next Veterans Chronicles, when we return our weekly World War II Chronicle and a salute to another American military hero.
World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from Northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Jiaxin area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network.